This is the 2017 Pacific Northwest Daughters of Sarah Weekend. Brother Roger Lewis is leading our studies on the topic, Hannah, Handmaid of the Highest. This is Class 6, entitled, Hannah and Her Hope. Introductory reading was 1 Samuel 2, verse 20 to 26.
So Hannah and her hope. We're sort of coming to the end of the story, but we're not quite there yet. So we need both today and tomorrow before the journey will be done. So you remember in this previous section that we saw how Hannah ascended to Shiloh for that yearly pilgrimage, and she brought with her that priestly mantle to place upon her son. And that little coat, so full of significance and meaning, was her testimony to her rejection of the priesthood of Hophni and Phinehas. And you remember that there was good reason for her to feel that way, wasn't there? Because those verses 13 and 14 and 15 and 16 clearly indicate not only how corrupt the priesthood was, but the very marks of the man of the clenched fist and the man of the brazen mouth are there in the aggressive actions and the arrogant words that took place, destroying not only Yahweh's meal with his people, but the people's meal with Yahweh, so that fellowship was made absolutely impossible. And so that little coat, so full of significance, testified to her rejection of the apostate priesthood of the day. But I think the little coat was more than that as well, because it was a robe of destiny. God was really being called on by Hannah in the placing of that robe upon her son. She was in effect calling upon God for a new and better priest to confirm Samuel as his choice of that priest, after the spirit of an order higher than that of the sons of Aaron, hence the Nazarite vow that came upon this child. And so the unique garments that the little boy wore, and the early promise of his spiritual demeanor, and the special character of his Nazarite vow from the womb and all the days of his life, were indicators that marked him out for priesthood in that new and special way. When she came up year by year and put that little coat on, and remember what she was saying was that she called Samuel to be her priest, and she called upon God to vindicate that choice from heaven above. She was quite a strong mother, wasn't she? And how blessed for Samuel's life that she was. So verse 20 says, and Eli blessed Elkanah and his wife, and said, Yahweh give thee seed of this woman for the loan which is lent to Yahweh, and they went unto their own home. It's interesting really what verse 20 says, because We understand that Eli was a weak man. He was certainly weak in disciplining his sons. We know that he's eventually going to be judged for failing to restrain his sons. And yet I think as we read verse 20, we get the sense that actually Eli really liked little Samuel. I think he had an affinity for the little boy. So the record says that Eli blessed Elkanah and his wife. And the reason why we know that, he actually had an admiration, I think, for Hannah and Elkanah as well as their little boy. And I think we refer to them in that order, incidentally, because even though Eli addresses his blessing here to Elkanah, the cause of his blessing relates to Hannah's vision and Hannah's vow and Hannah's loan, as he goes on to say. So he says, verse 20, the Lord give thee, Yahweh give thee seed of this woman for the loan which is lent unto Yahweh. So Green's literal says, Yahweh shall give you seed of this woman because of the petition she prayed to Yahweh, or the Revised Standard Version. Yahweh give you children by this woman for the loan which she lent to Yahweh. By the way, I think that takes us back to chapter 1, verse 26. Remember she said, O my Lord, I am the woman. I'm the woman that prayed right here beside you. And now he says to Elkanah, may Yahweh give thee seed of this woman. It's the woman that came to him in the first place and prayed. It's the woman that brought the child back 4 years later. God give thee seed of this woman, he says. You see, I think Eli had never forgotten the story of this woman. And the presence of little Samuel in the sanctuary every day vividly brought the story of Hannah back into the mind of the old man Eli. See, the mother of the child was the cause of this spontaneous outpouring by Eli. He invoked in the name of God, in the name of Yahweh himself, that he might bring about a fullness of recompense into their lives because of what they had done. And what they had done, of course, was given the supreme gift of their firstborn son together. Here was a priestly intercessor indeed. And I think that we gather also from verse 20 that when it says that Eli blessed Elkanah and his wife in this way, I think that verse 20 probably is indicating that it wasn't a single act of blessing. It wasn't the first time he came. It wasn't the first time, rather, that Hannah and Elkanah came. So the New International Version says, Eli would bless Elkanah and his wife. And then the end of the verse says, and then they would go home. Or Rodahim says, and Eli used to bless Elkanah and his wife. And then at the end of the verse it says, and so they went their way. And so I think what verse 20 is actually implying is that as they came up every single year, Eli blessed them again. So they came up the year after Samuel's been left. She brings the little coat, and before they've gone home, Eli blesses them. Every year as they made their yearly pilgrimage, Eli repeated his priestly blessing. And the blessing was, Yahweh give thee seed of this woman for the loan which is lent unto Yahweh. And year by year they came back, and guess what? They came back with another child, and another child, and another child, and another child. And every time he said, Yahweh give thee seed, and he blessed them, they'd come back with another child the next year. So it was sort of like this cycle of blessing going on as they brought the children back in their train, a growing number of children actually in their train, in a growing cycle of fruitfulness. By the way, I think there's overtones here of the story of Boaz and Ruth. If you come back just again a couple of pages to Ruth chapter 4, just notice again, bearing in mind that Ruth is an appendix, of course, to the book of Judges, but notice the similarity of language here, similarity of ideas. In Ruth chapter 4 and verse 11 it says, all the people that were in the gate and the elders said, we are witnesses. Yahweh make the woman that has come into thy house like Rachel and like Leah, which too did build the house of Israel, and do thou worthily in Ephratah, and be thou famous in Bethlehem. So Yahweh make the woman like Rachel and Leah. May you be blessed with fertility and fruitfulness from this union. And so verse 13 says, so Boaz took Ruth, and she was his wife. And by the way, the woman that he took, it says that Yahweh gave her conception and she bare a son, because actually, Ruth had been a barren woman for 10 years in Moab before this, just like Hannah. And now she bears. Verse 14 says, the woman said unto Naomi, blessed be Yahweh, which hath not left thee this day without a kinsman, that his name might be famous. So as we read through the story, and of a child, finally in verse 15, that would be a restorer and a nourisher, better than seven sons, all the language of Ruth 4 here. Yahweh make the woman like Rachel and Leah, the seed which Yahweh shall give thee of this young woman. Yahweh gave her conception. He shall be a restorer and a nourisher. All this, I think, turns up in the story now of Hannah and of Eli's blessing upon her. And I think that what that tells us, you see, all of this is evidence of the profound effect that this little Levite had upon Eli. I think Eli loved him. And the thing is, he was also profoundly affected by Hannah herself. See, I think Eli loved the truth. I think he actually loved the truth. But he lacked the strength to discipline his offspring. It was unutterably sad, because when he finally understood that he hadn't, it was too late. But when he saw this little boy in the sanctuary every day, with shining eyes and serious disposition and earnest heart and a little robe, do you know what he saw? Do you know what Eli saw? He saw all that he'd lost in his own sons. All that he would love to have been able to do if he'd had the chance to do it all over again, he saw it in this little boy. I think he loved him. But it's too late for Eli to actually affect his own household. So the marvelous thing is that Eli, that brings this blessing upon this woman who had so mightily affected him, and Elkanah, says in verse 21 that Yahweh did visit Hannah so that she conceived. And so now then, that phrase, Eli blessed Elkanah, of verse 20, now becomes Yahweh visited Hannah, of verse 21. Isn't that an interesting connection? Eli blessed Elkanah, but Yahweh visited Hannah. And that's how this story of fruitfulness was going to unfold. And so upon Hannah then would come the blessing of divine visitation and favor. Similar, by the way, not only to Ruth in bearing a special son, but I think reminiscent of the intervention of God in another circumstance, in another life, in another woman's life, earlier on in the divine record. Because if you come back to Genesis chapter 21, we've got the story of the birth of Isaac. To who? Why, to a barren woman. And her name is Sarah. But just look at the language of Genesis chapter 21 and see again if you can sense the spirit and the story of Hannah in this story from an earlier time. Genesis chapter 21 puts it this way concerning the experience of Sarah. So verse 1, Genesis 21, verses 1 and 2, and then 6 to 8. And Yahweh visited Sarah as he had said. And Yahweh did unto Sarah as he had spoken. For Sarah conceived and bare Abram a son in his old age at the set time of which God had spoken to him. And verse 6 says, and Sarah said, God hath made me to laugh, so that all that hear will laugh with me. And she said, who would have said unto Abram that Sarah should have given children suck? For I have borne him a son in his old age. And the child grew and was weaned. And Abram made a great feast the same day Isaac was weaned. And all those words visited Sarah. Sarah conceived. God's made me to laugh. I've given children suck. The child grew. The child was weaned. Well, this is all language out of the story of Hannah, isn't it? And it's reminiscent. It's all caught up in the Spirit's phrase back in the 1 Samuel chapter 2 here, where in verse 21 it says simply, and Yahweh visited Hannah. And somehow we capture all of these other analogies and other parallels. How much of this do you think Hannah knew and treasured in her heart? Do you think she knew the story of Sarah? I'm sure she did. Do you think she knew the story of Ruth? I'm sure she did. She treasured all these ideas in her heart. And so the record says in verse 21 that having visited Hannah, she conceived indeed, and she bare 3 sons and 2 daughters. And the child Samuel grew before Yahweh. So now she's got 1 child in Shiloh, but she now has another 5 children at home who would be rightfully hers to raise. And so we could argue, couldn't we, that Hannah, whose name means grace, has now received a full measure of the Father's grace upon her. She's got 5 little children at home. But when we add the child Samuel, who stayed in Shiloh, she's got a total of 6 children. Now, she'd alluded to Ruth in her own prayer, hadn't she? The 1 Samuel chapter 2, verse 5, and the prayer she offered earlier on. She, the barren woman, hath borne 7. But actually, Hannah never did have 7, did she? And I think that was in the providence of God. That barren woman, though she was, and visited though she was by God, God only ever gave Hannah 6 children. The Lord left her short of the 7th, that she might live for that hope, that one day the 7th would come. She looked for one to come, but not yet. not now. And when he came, he would be the Messiah that all were waiting for. And Hannah will join her prayer with others when this one comes. Unto us a child is born. Unto us a son is given. But not yet. So she's left with six in order that she also might look forward to the seventh, who would complete the story of her own life and all that was being foreshadowed in Samuel's. And so verse 22 says, now Eli was very old and heard all that his sons did unto all Israel, how they lay with the woman that assembled at the door of the tabernacle of the congregation. Clearly what we're being told in verse 22 is that at some point his age prevented him from supervising the tabernacle activities. He couldn't do them anymore. But the problem was that that corrupt form of worship that had been introduced was now already in practice so deeply entrenched that it was impossible for him to change it or to challenge it or to stop it. And now his advanced years makes it impossible for him to reverse it. He's no longer in charge. And so these sons of Belial are now in control of everything. He's just an old man, in fact, a very old man. As we've said, I think he's probably at least 80 by this time. He's going to live for another 18 years. But he's too old now. It says he heard all that they did. And their spirit affected all the matters at the sanctuary. And of course, Hannah knew full well that this old man was powerless. And I think that's partly why she prayed for a son in the first place. Because going up year by year, she not only saw the wickedness of Hophni and Phinehas, but she understood that Eli couldn't change it. She knew he couldn't. So she prayed to break the cycle of these men that their father couldn't. But Eli knew, he'd heard it all. And what he'd heard, verse 22, was that his sons lay with the woman that assembled at the door of the tabernacle of the congregation. Now, let me just take you on a little journey to explain this word assembled, because I think it's crucial to the story. In fact, it'll be more crucial to the story than perhaps we first realise. If you come back to the book of Numbers, chapter 4, let me show you that word in the book of the law. Assembled. It's in Numbers, chapter 4, and in verse 23. This is one of the places where it's used. Numbers 4, verse 23. And in this particular case, it's talking about the sons of Gershom. It says, verse 23, from 30 years old and upward until 50 years old shalt thou number them, all that enter in to perform the service, to do the work in the tabernacle of the congregation. But you see in the margin, all that enter in to perform the service, the margin says, all that enter in to war the warfare. That's an interesting expression, isn't it? They came to war the warfare. This was a spiritual war. And again, if you come to Numbers chapter 8 and verses 24 to 26, right at the end of the chapter, we will be told something very similar, where it says this in verse 24. This is that that belongeth unto the Levites, from 25 years old and upward shall they go in to war the warfare of the service, says the margin. But the authorized version says, to wait upon the service. And likewise, verse 25, and from the age of 50 years, they shall cease waiting upon the service. The margin says, they shall return from the warfare of the service. Now, that word in the Hebrew is the word tsaba, T-S-A-B-A, which means to fight and to muster and to assemble. Ah, so there's the word. It means to assemble. But it's a military term suggesting conscription for service. And interestingly enough, that word tsaba is the root word of Yahweh Tsavayoth, the Lord of hosts, the assembly of people, conscripted for service to become God's armies in the warfare of the truth. In fact, this whole idea of the warfare, I think, we won't turn this up, but I'll just give you a cross-reference. I think that idea from the book of Numbers about the Levites warring the warfare, I suggest is possibly the scriptural basis for what Paul says to Timothy when in the 1st of Timothy chapter 1 and verse 18 he says, "This charge I commit unto thee, son Timothy, according to the prophecies that went before on thee, that thou by them mightest war a good warfare," says the apostle. And I think that that idea, that expression, is taken out of this word in the book of Numbers about the service of the Levites. They came to war the warfare of the truth. So that's what these Levites did. They assembled for the warfare of the service of the truth in the sanctuary. But there were women involved in this battle as well. Now, if you come to Exodus chapter 38, we have reference to those women who were also involved in this battle. Because in Exodus chapter 38 and verse 8 it says, "And he made the laver of brass and the foot of it of brass, made out of the looking glasses of the women assembling, which assembled at the door of the tabernacle of the congregation." The margin says they assembled by troops, but it's the same word for war, the warfare of the Levites. It's Saba. So these women came to war the warfare as well as the Levites. Now, who were these women? They were women who devoted themselves in some way to the service of the truth, and particularly to the matters of the sanctuary. And when you think about it, it makes sense that that was the case, because the sanctuary service had lots of things to be done. There were lots of utensils, there were lots of offerings, there were lots of hangings, there were lots of things that had to be administered. And so there were women involved in the service of the sanctuary. In fact, if you come to Numbers chapter 31, in the case of one of the battles where some foreign women were captured in battle in the days of Phinehas, we're told this in Numbers 31, and reading from verse 26 to start with, it says in verses 26 and 27, Yahweh said to Moses, so it's God's saying, not Moses' saying, he says, "Take the sum of the prey that was taken, both of man and beast, thou and Eleazar the priest and the chief of the fathers of the congregation, and divide the prey into two parts, between them that took war upon them, who went out to battle, and between all the congregation, and levy a tribute unto Yahweh of the men of war which went out to battle." And as a result of that division of labor, what we're told in verse 35, firstly, that there were persons that were devoted to the high priest, of whom it says that these were women that had not known man by lying with him. And the record says in verse 40, the persons were 16,000, of which Yahweh's tribute was 32 persons. So those 32 virgins were given to the matters of the sanctuary. So verse 47 said, "Even of the children of Israel's half, Moses took one portion of 50, both of man and beast, and gave them unto the Levites, which kept the charge of the tabernacle." So there were virgins captured in war that were sent to the service of the tabernacle. And in many respects, that would have been an honoured and an honourable position. They were sent for service under the authority of both the high priest and the Levites. And I think there's something about this, you see. There's something about that spirit of what it meant for them to be virgins in that context. If you come to the book of Corinthians, you'll remember in the 1st of Corinthians chapter 7, we have the apostles' comments upon both marriage, but also on the virgin state. And I want you to notice what he says about virgins, because it's instructive and helpful. The apostle Paul says in the 1st of Corinthians chapter 7, in giving his advice upon virgins, he makes this comment in verses 34 and 35. He said, "There is a difference also between a wife and a virgin. The unmarried woman careth for the things of the Lord, that she may be holy both in body and in spirit. But she that is married careth for the things of the world, how she may please her husband. And this I speak for your own profit, not that I may cast a snare upon you, but for that which is comely, and that ye may attend upon the Lord without distraction. So the teaching of the Apostle Paul in his time, and by the way, given particular circumstances, which was the impending catastrophe of AD 70, the Apostle said, those that decide to remain virgins do well, because they can attend upon the matters of the Lord and do so with such devotion of both mind and body that they might be profitable in the service without any other distracting cares in life. That's what those virgins were like at the tabernacle of the congregation. They gave themselves to that work, to that service. Gave themselves utterly to the service of the house of God. In fact, I think they're alluded to at the time of the destruction of the temple. If you come back to Lamentations chapter 1, you see what it says in the book of Lamentations in chapter 1, when Jeremiah laments the catastrophe of the overthrow of the city. He says this, Lamentations chapter 1 and verse 4. I think there's an allusion to those virgins, you see, at the temple. It says, the ways of Zion do mourn, because none come to the solemn feasts. That's the temple. All her gates are desolate. Her priests sigh. Her virgins are afflicted. And she is in bitterness. And so these were honored and honorable women whose lives were devoted at the sanctuary to spiritual things, whether in fasting or praying or singing, whether in making or cleansing or preparing, they served at the sanctuary. They weren't priests, they couldn't offer sacrifices, they didn't give priestly blessings, but there was a multitude of tasks that the sanctuary might operate, and these women were part of the warfare. They were virgins that assembled at the door of the tabernacle of the congregation. Now, when we come back to the book of Samuel, let's come back now to the 1 Samuel chapter 2, but you see, we've got a context now. We've got a context that this, in fact, was the case. There were virgins that, from a long time earlier, had been devoted to the matters of the sanctuary, and that's exactly where they came. They assembled at the door of the tabernacle of the congregation. So when it says, in the 1 Samuel chapter 2 and verse 22, that Hophni and Phinehas lay with the women that assembled at the door of the tabernacle of the congregation. Well, these are the women that this reference is talking about. These that had committed themselves to Yahweh's service as virgins at the sanctuary. Now, this can only have happened for two reasons. Either they were so far removed from the spirit of those who gave their mirrors to Moses because they rejected the vanity of outward appearance and gave themselves utterly to the service of God. Either these women are so far removed from that it doesn't matter anymore because they're part of the corruption. Or the priests, Hophni and Phinehas, on whose approval the food and the clothes and the accommodation and the livelihoods of these women depended, were simply told that more was expected of them if they wanted to stay. And they had nowhere else to go. And what this chapter tells us is that corruption of doctrine, verses 13 to 17, is inevitably followed by corruption of practice. Verse 22. When we start to lose the doctrines of the truth, we start to lose the conduct of the truth. So we don't know what the answer was. But these women may have been put in a very difficult, if not impossible, situation. And given the spirit of Hophni and Phinehas, why would we be surprised that might have been the case? So Eli says, verse 23, he said unto them, why do ye such things? For I hear of your evil doings by all the people. So at least he makes remonstrance. But he had no power to change. And this was a wickedness, you see, so notorious as to be evidenced by a widespread and general complaint throughout the congregation as a whole. Everyone knew about it. It was no secret. The whole of Israel knew what was going on at the sanctuary. Eli must have been ashamed and embarrassed by what his sons were like and how his sons behaved in this particular context. Why do you do such things, he says. And so he says, verse 24, nay, my sons, it is no good report that I hear. Ye make Yahweh's people to transgress. And so the life led by the priest so publicly, so obviously in the sanctuary, was so scornful of holy ordinances. Their open and brazen immorality corrupted the religious life of the nation, so there was nothing left anymore. Do you know how the Septuagint translates the end of verse 24? You make Yahweh's people to transgress. The Septuagint says, ye make Yahweh's people cease to worship him. That was the source of Hannah's grief. That's why she hated this. Ye make Yahweh's people cease to worship him. That's what she grieved about. The impact of Hophni and Phinehas on the spiritual worship of the nation. That's why she grieved. That's why she couldn't eat. That's why she prayed for a son. That's why she gave praise. That's why she brought the little coat. All this controversy is well and truly joined now, isn't it? As far as Hannah's spirit and mind is concerned. And this is why. This is exactly why. Because of all of this. And so verse 25, we're told that Eli said to his sons, if one man sin against another, the judge shall judge him. But if a man sin against Yahweh, who shall entreat for him? And clearly the sense of that is, as was read to us, is that first part of verse 25, what Eli is saying is, if a man sins against God, who will entreat for him? And the answer is, well, of course, he needed a priest. He needed a priest to entreat for him if a man sinned against God. But you see, Hophni and Phinehas had sinned so grievously against God themselves, and what Eli, their father, is saying is, who can you go to for intercession? You are the priests. How can you have intercession made to God for you? You're the priests. You can't go to intercede for your sin. You've put yourself in an impossible situation, and Eli pleaded with them to realize the terrible predicament they had placed themselves in. You've placed yourself beyond the scope for intercession or forgiveness. And the record says, notwithstanding, they hearkened not unto the voice of their father, because Yahweh would slay them. So the father's reproof made no impression. Now we're told in a number of places, aren't we, in Scripture about the hardening of hearts and how God has worked with the hardening of hearts. When it says that Pharaoh's heart was hardened, and it implies that God hardened his heart. No, God didn't harden Pharaoh's heart. God permitted Pharaoh the free will choice to harden his own heart, and then God worked with that hardness of heart to accomplish his own purpose. And these two boys are heading headlong towards their own destruction. They don't know it yet, but they're well on the way. And part of that hardness of heart is that a grieving father can no longer have any impact on their lives whatsoever, and they sealed their own fate by their refusal to take warning from anyone in the context of their unrighteous behavior. And in the Hebrew, at the end of that verse, it's extraordinarily strong, much more so than the Authorized Version would suggest. Because the Authorized Version says, they hearken not unto the voice of their father because Yahweh would slay them. But the Hebrew is stronger than that. The ASV says, because Yahweh was minded to slay them. Green's literal says, because Yahweh desired to execute them. Young's literal says, Yahweh has delighted to put them to death. And that's an astonishing thing. Can you imagine that? That's what God says about these two men. It was God's delight to put them to death. Can we have any imagination of what it must have been like in the sanctuary in those days, and why Hannah had felt exactly why she had? Oh yes, their judgment was coming. What those two men didn't realize is that that little boy right there in the sanctuary where they were had sealed their fate. God already planned to work through that child. Their time would come, and soon enough. And isn't it remarkable that the record writes itself up in such a way that after all of that evil, verse 26 says, "And the child Samuel grew on and was in favor both with Yahweh and also with men." Incidentally, it's not always easy for those two categories to both work. Child Samuel grew on and was in favor both with God and with men. It's possible to be in favor with God, but managing that and also being in favor with men is not easy because of the perversity of human nature. But this little boy was. In Samuel's case, even as a lad, there was an exhibition of dedication so wholesome that somehow everyone that looked upon this lad couldn't help but approve of his godly ways. Now, here's the paradox. Because I think there is a paradox in verse 26. Especially coming hard on the heels, as it does, after verses 22 to 25. So the priests in this place were evil to their core. The honor of the sacrifices was corrupted. The worship of the sanctuary was defiled by immorality. It had reached a point of no return. As we said in an earlier study, the very center of wickedness in the land was the sanctuary itself. And yet the strange thing is, verse 26, that Samuel walked through the midst of all of this, and he seemed to live a charmed life where no evil touched him and no harm reached him. Now, how was that? Well, of course, the obvious answer is that Yahweh's providential care kept him safe. We believe that. But the question is, what instrument did God providentially use to keep the little boy safe? That's the burning question, isn't it? So ask yourself this question, as every sister does. Much more so than brothers, by the way, because sisters think about everything and how everything connects to everything else. You think about all the details, because that's how sisters are made. And by the way, that's such a wonderful thing when it comes to Bible passages and thinking about Bible passages. So think about this one. You see, what would be the greatest need of a very young child living at the sanctuary but separated from his home? A child, because of his age, who still needs the nurture and care of someone who can help him to eat and to drink and to sleep and to rise and to wash and to dress and to speak and to read and to sing and to pray and to learn and to grow. How's all this going to happen with a little three-year-old in the sanctuary, even if Hannah was confident to leave him there? He needed the guardian care of a mother, not an 80-year-old man. And Yahweh in his goodness provided such a mother. And the mother wasn't in Ramah. I think this mother was in Shiloh. And I think there was a virgin at the tabernacle who was ready to be that mother. So let's come back and have a look at her, shall we? Because I think she is the woman of Judges chapter 11. So see what the record says in Judges chapter 11. We've already discovered how the book of Samuel follows straight on from the record of Judges. All these chapters are much more close chronologically than you might have understood. So in Judges chapter 11, we're told of a vow that a man made, and it's in verse 30, when it says that Jephthah vowed a vow unto Yahweh and said, if thou wilt without fail deliver the children of Ammon into my hands, then it shall be that whatsoever cometh forth at the doors of my house to meet me, when I return in peace from the children of Ammon, shall surely be Yahweh's, and I will offer it up for a burnt offering. So we all know about the vow of Jephthah. I want you to just notice the overtones in Jephthah's story to actually Samuel's story. Because what happens here is a man makes a vow. And what does he vow? He says, if you will do this for me, O God, then I will give you somebody. And incidentally, that's exactly how we should translate it. Because you see that word whatsoever in verse 31? It doesn't mean whatsoever, it means whosoever. Jephthah always had in mind a person. He had someone in mind as a person that he would give to God if God gave him victory against the children of the Ammonites at that stage. And that person, he says, shall surely be Yahweh's. Now, you see what it says? This is where the puzzle has always been, the problem has always been. You see what it says in the next bit? It says, and I will offer it up for a burnt offering. That's not what the Hebrew says. First of all, you need to understand that the word for is not in the Hebrew. It doesn't say in the Hebrew, I will offer him up for a burnt offering. In fact, in the Hebrew, that whole phrase, I will offer him up for a burnt offering, is only two Hebrew words. Wahalatu ola. And wahalatu ola literally means, I will offer him, that is God, a burnt offering. I will offer him a burnt offering. Now, that burnt offering wasn't the person, it's the offering of dedication that accompanies that person. What Jephthah did was vowed a person to the service of God. And when that person was brought to the service, there would be a burnt offering that would accompany that person. Why would there be a burnt offering to accompany the person? Because the burnt offering symbolizes the dedication of the person. Now, where have we come across the story before where someone vows a child and brings the child to the house of God, and with the child that's being dedicated to God, there is also brought a burnt offering to be burnt to symbolize the child? In fact, wasn't it a child of 3 years old and one bullock of 3 years old? And the bullock was burnt as a burnt offering to symbolize that the child was about to be given to Eli. This is exactly the story of Hannah vowing Samuel. I think that's exactly what Jephthah did. And right from the start, he anticipated, he intended to actually offer someone to God. There was no indication in this passage that he was simply going to slaughter them. That doesn't honor God. There's no honor to God in slaughtering a person. Now, let me briefly mention why I think that's right, so that we can come back to the story. When the daughter hears, notice what she says. Verse 36. She said unto him, my father, if thou hast opened thy mouth unto Yahweh, do to me according to that which hath proceeded out of thy mouth. Oh, where does that come from? That's the law of vows. Remember, that which proceeds out of thy mouth, thou must do. Numbers 30, verse 1. She understood that. Jephthah's daughter understood the principle of vows. If this has come out of your mouth, then you must perform. If this person that you intended to devote to God, to give to God, to dedicate to God... See, I think Jephthah had someone else in mind, by the way. I don't think he had his daughter in mind at all. That's absolutely true. But he had someone in mind. But she says, verse 37, let this thing be done for me. Let me alone 2 months, that I may go up and down upon the mountains and bewail my virginity, I and my fellows. And he said, go. And he sent her away for 2 months. And she went away with her companions. And there in the privacy of the mountains, she bewailed her virginity upon the mountains. Now just stop and think about the principle of what's being mentioned here in verse 37 and verse 38. You see, do you notice that she bewailed her virginity, not her impending death? Because she wasn't going to die. So she didn't bewail death, because death wasn't what was about to happen. What she bewailed was her virginity. Now, why would she be bewailing her virginity? Well, because the principle of the whole burnt offering was dedication in perpetuity. And what that meant, if Jephthah fulfilled his vow, is that she would be dedicated for the whole of her life to God. And that included the part that might have been offered to a husband and a family. She didn't mourn because she had to die a virgin. She mourned because she had to live as a virgin. And that virginity stood in some peculiar relation to the nature of her vow, which was that she would be given utterly to Yahweh's service as a virgin at the sanctuary. Now, do you think that's right? See verse 39. It came to pass at the end of 2 months that she returned unto her father, who did with her according to his vow which she had vowed, and she knew no man. Now, if all he had done was kill her, then adding the phrase, she knew no man, doesn't add anything to the idea of death, because we already know that she's a virgin. So if we know she's a virgin, and then it says, and her father killed her, and then it says, and she knew no man, it's only repeating what we already know, is that she was a virgin when her father killed her. Ah, but if she's alive, then what this is saying is that she was dedicated for life, and the fact that she knew no man was the proof that her vow was fulfilled. That she went to the temple, she went to the tabernacle, and she knew no man because that's how her vow would be lived out for the rest of her life. And she bewailed at least the loss of a husband and the chance of a family in her own right. And so verse 40 says, it was a custom in Israel, that the daughters of Israel went yearly to lament the daughter of Jephthah the Gileadite 4 days in a year. Now, notice verse 40, the daughters of Israel went yearly. Oh, that's interesting. The margin says, from year to year. Where have we heard that before? They went up year by year. That's a visit to Shiloh, isn't it? That's a visit to the tabernacle. That's where this woman was. And when it says they went to lament, that word is only used here. And in one other place, it's in the book of Judges. Have I got it here? No, I don't think I do, but I know where it is. The only other place where that word is used is back in Deborah's song in Judges 5, where it says, in verse 11, there shall they rehearse the righteous acts of Yahweh. And that word rehearse is the same word here, lament. So Kimchi, who was a noted Hebrew scholar, said the word actually means to celebrate or to talk with. They went up every year to talk with Jephthah's daughter. Where did they go year by year to talk with her? Why, where everyone went year by year, they went up to the sacrifice, to the sanctuary, to Shiloh. That's where she was, you see. Jephthah's daughter was given to the Lord that she might serve without distraction, attending upon the things of the Lord at the sanctuary. Now, let me tell you something else interesting about Jephthah, just before we leave this page. Do you know that of all the book of Judges, from Judges 1 right through to Judges 21, there's no chronology ever given in the book of Judges. There's only one point historically noted in the entire book of Judges where we can pinpoint any single judge. And you never guess which judge we can pinpoint historically, would you? Why, it's Jephthah. Now, here it is. It's in Judges 11, in verse 26, right here in this chapter. He says, in his conversation with the Ammonites, while Israel dwelt, why didn't you take these cities back? While Israel dwelt in Heshbon and her towns, and in Aroah and her towns, and in all the cities that be along by the coast of Arnon, why, he says, these last 300 years, and you've never come and tried to take them? 300 years. Now that's 300 years from the conquest of the land under Joshua. Now the normal date for the Exodus is 1446. And the time period that's normally deemed to be the entry into the land by conquest is 1406, obviously 40 years later, because the wilderness wanderings are completed. From 1406, if you take Jephthah's 300 years, we're now at 1106. Now, I'm not going to go into the chronology, which is somewhat complicated, but suffice to say this. I've got a calculation here, which you'll be most welcome to see afterwards. But if you take Jephthah's daughter as being 20 at the time that her father died, because he only judged for 6 years, that between that and the 25th year of Eli, why do I say the 25th? How many years did Eli judge? 40 years. But remember, Samuel is born about 15 years before Eli dies. So he's born only into about year 25 of Eli's 40 years of judgment, and then Samuel's born. At that moment, Jephthah's daughter will be about 70. She's an old lady, a very old lady. Now, just stop and think about this. Think about the remarkable aspect of this. Because you see, I think what we're being told is that in the wisdom of God, God already plans for everything long before circumstances arise. So behind the scenes, when it says in the 1 Samuel chapter 2, verse 26, so we just go back there, let's finish our story in the right spot. So when it says in the 1 Samuel chapter 2 and verse 26, and the child Samuel grew on and was in favor both with Yahweh and also with man. I think the point that we're making is that that wasn't an accident. Yes, it was under Yahweh's care. But I think Yahweh, in his providential care, made sure that the right person was in the right place at just the right time to be a mother to this little boy. You know, one of the marvelous things about what God can do? He can bring together in one action something that suits the needs of many different people. And in one single action, I think that what Almighty God do in his amazing wisdom was, Samuel was guided, Hannah was comforted, and Jephthah's daughter was fulfilled because she had a child to love, a child to look after, a child to guard. Do you think Jephthah's daughter was strong spiritually? She absolutely comes across that way in the record. And now, when she would never ever have dreamed it was possible to have a child, out of the blue, in the providence of God, a little boy turns up on her doorstep at the door of the tabernacle of the congregation. Do you think that woman might have guarded that child with all her love and all her affection? Oh, yes. Who do you think put the little ephod on the boy? I think it was this woman. And when Hannah came up with a little coat each year, she would be comforted to know that there was a guardian mother looking after her child. See, God can do astonishing things, can't he? Above and beyond what we could ever imagine might be possible. And I think that's how God arranged this, in his providential wisdom. So as Hophni and Phinehas fell, Samuel arose. And the waning of the one became the waxing of the other. One must decrease, the other must increase. And the whole narrative is now going to sweep on through the rest of the chapter that we won't look at. But in the rest of the chapter, what we're going to be brought to, ultimately, is the promise of verse 35, when it says, when God says, I will raise me up a faithful priest that shall do according to all that's in my heart and mind. There's been different suggestions as to who the faithful priest was, and ultimately it has to be our Lord Jesus Christ, who combines priesthood and kingship in the two roles. But in the immediate context of Hannah, see what it must mean. Verse 34, this shall be a sign unto thee that shall come upon thy two sons, on Hophni and Phinehas, in one day they shall die both of them, and I will raise me up a faithful priest. Now, in the context of raising up a faithful priest, hard on the heels of the death of Hophni and Phinehas, who could that priest be? There's only one person that could possibly be in the immediate context, and that's Samuel himself. And I think that's what God is saying. God is endorsing all of Hannah's desires, all of Hannah's prayers. Yes, Hannah, I will use your son, and in him I will raise up the faithful priest that the nation needs. And the reason why I think we know that is because, do you see what it says in chapter 3 and verse 20? It says, and all Israel from Dan, even to Beersheba, knew that Samuel was established to be a prophet. But the margin says, they knew that Samuel was faithful. And that's the same word for the faithful priest of chapter 2, verse 35. They knew that Samuel was the one. He's the faithful priest. God had it all worked out. And so it would come to pass in the wisdom of God. Now, the funny thing is about that story as it comes to a close. Well, it sort of comes to a close. The strange thing is that when we come to the gospel records, there's one gospel in particular that focuses on our Lord Jesus Christ as a little child. And only one gospel. And not only will that gospel tell us over and over and over again about Jesus as a little child, which no other gospel will tell us about, but will describe him in language that comes straight out of the life of Samuel. And it's that same gospel that will record why Mary's prayer, quoting Hannah's prayer. And when we look into the story of that gospel, we suddenly discover that every single person in this story, in the first of Samuel, chapter 1 and 2, every single character in this story will turn up in the gospel of Luke. The question is, why did Luke do that? And why only does Luke do that in his gospel? Well, that is the subject of our exhortation tomorrow. So let's close with a hymn that we actually used on our opening introductory study night on Thursday, but let's sing it again. Hymn 146, verse 2. The old man, meek and mild, the priest of Israel slept, his watch, the temple child, the little Levite kept, and what from Eli's sense was sealed, the Lord to Hannah's son revealed. Hymn 146.